From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and for the first time on our show, Sylvester Monroe, assistant foreign editor at the Washington Post, in charge of Europe and South Asia. Sylvester, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Here are the issues. The Obama administration and Russian President Vladimir Putin now agree on leaving Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in power. We are not seeking regime change, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said. Time magazine named German Chancellor Angela Merkel the person of the year in 2015, but she and leaders of the 28-nation or European Union failed again to reach a deal on handling the immigration crisis. Meanwhile, the United Nations Security Council is aiming to cut off the flow of money to terrorists of Islamic State, also known as ISIS. And Republicans held another debate among presidential candidates, with Senators Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio emerging as sharp rivals on foreign policy and immigration. Well, Tom, I'll start with you. I don't know whether I should have been surprised, but I was surprised at Secretary of State John Kerry's announcement that we're not seeking regime change. We're on the same wavelength as the Russians on leaving the Syrian president in power. But it was a big change. I mean, de facto, that was already going on, but it still surprised me.
It was, Fred, it was going on de facto already. The bottom line is the Russians are not ready to pull the plug on Assad, and pragmatists around President Obama, I think, agree that there would be even more chaos if Assad were to go. Now, I think the U.S. believes that at some point, as part of a negotiated settlement in Syria, if there ever is one, Assad will be transitioning out. So I think the basic view of the U.S. government is that this situation will take care of itself in a few months or a year or so. But in the meantime, you can't get rid of Assad without the Russian support and because of the chaos that it would generate. So it's rhetorically new, but it's not actually new.
Well, let me go back to this. Were you surprised, Sylvester?
Not really. I think it's practical. It was a practical move because they need to work together on the ground there in Syria. I mean, you can't – I don't think the United States really trust Putin, but, you know, they need to work with him right now.
What's possible that they can work out? I'll start with you, Sylvester. What would be on their agenda, the Obama-Putin agenda?
In terms of Syria?
Yes.
Well, I mean, the whole deal with ISIS, with Islamic State there, is that they seem to be – I mean, they pop up here, they pop up there. You know, there was just this offensive where a whole bunch of ISIS fighters, you know, were killed, and yet they keep popping up. So I think working together there, this coalition, which has had some problems – as I said, they need Putin right now, even though he has created a bit of chaos with these airstrikes.
He certainly has. Tom, what do you think about the Obama-Putin agenda?
Well, I think the U.S. would certainly like to see some sort of a ceasefire. I don't think we're anywhere near that at the moment. But let's don't forget that the Russians lost over 200 nationals in the plane crash in the Sinai, now generally believed to have been a terrorist attack. And so Putin now, I think, has gotten new religion, so to speak, on the threat of ISIS to Russia. And so I think the U.S. is looking for a ceasefire at some point, and also Putin's help in dealing with ISIS, at least in Syria and maybe in Iraq. I think this is one of those rare instances where there is a commonality of mutual interest, at least for a little bit in a limited sense. So I think they're trying to – the U.S. is trying to do that. It's Putin is an unsavory character, but he's a important character who cannot be ignored, who cannot be just – told to go in a corner and stay there. And so engagement, for the most part, engagement is better than non-engagement.
What about a no-fly zone? Is that just something the Russians aren't interested in?
I don't think they're interested in it, but I think that's – I know we'll get to the debates in this program a little later, but that is – a no-fly zone would work, but the Russians would have to agree to it, and that's very, very tricky. The Russians don't want to do anything that suggests that their sovereign authority is being diminished in any way. So they don't want that. But I think as part of a negotiated settlement, a no-fly zone might be useful.
Yeah. Sylvester?
I think so. And I agree with Tom that Putin and the Russians, they do not like to be told what to do or to be seen in any way sort of capitulating to, you know, some view that the United States has or some position being told what to do by the United States.
What about Putin having a 3.5-hour press conference? You're chuckling, Sylvester, and I do too. I mean, it's just so foreign. I mean, reporters complain when President Obama or other presidents go on with long answers to questions and the press conference goes over an hour. Reporters are getting nervous at the White House. 3.5 hours.
Well, these are standard in Russia. I mean, this is not the first one. He does it every year. Mm-hmm. And somebody asks, well, you know, how do you get that much TV time? Well, if you're the president of Russia, you ask for 3 hours, you get 3 hours. And you talk as long as you want.
And he's known for his howlers. He basically can say anything, and it's a passive audience. I was struck by the fact that he clearly still doesn't like President Obama much, but he seems to like Donald Trump.
He does. I mean, yeah,
he was.
What'd you make of that? I think he's following. He knows what Trump's been saying about, oh, I can get along with Putin and so on.
Well, we've said this from these microphones many times before, Fred. Putin respects strength. He respects power, and the perception has been in some quarters that he thinks he can push President Obama around. But Trump is his kind of guy, you know, bold, blustery, in many respects, a blowhard.
Yeah.
And so it's probably professional respect, so to speak. But it'll be interesting to see how that sorts out. Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin's favorite American politician, I don't think that's going to be a resounding positive theme in the general election, assuming Trump gets the nomination.
All right, I'm going to take a short break here. I'll get back to you on Trump in a moment. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Sylvester Monroe and Tom DeFrank. Donald Trump.
I was just going to say that I think these guys are made for each other. They're perfect foils. Neither of them likes Obama, and it's an easy way, sort of indirectly, to take jabs at President Obama.
I guess it is, yeah. I hadn't really thought of that. It is a good – it is a way. Okay, we're going to turn to the Angela Merkel, or as I guess maybe the Europeans call her, Angela Merkel, but I use the American pronunciation, was named by Time magazine. You all are both veterans of Newsweek, but nonetheless, she was named by Time magazine as Person of the Year, mainly for her activity on immigration crisis. Tom, what did you make of this and the crisis itself? I mean, they keep having these meetings. David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, said at this meeting that, oh, no, we didn't reach a deal, but we generated some momentum.
Yeah, no, that's... This is the kind of thing that people who are in the process of losing often say. No, they didn't have a deal, but I think that Time is probably right on the mark about Chancellor Merkel. It is the force of her personality. She is in terms of personality, she is a logical successor to Margaret Thatcher, the former prime minister of Great Britain. She's tough. She's strong. She's opinionated. And let's not forget that in addition to the refugee crisis. She was a leading figure in the past year during the Greek situation, mm-hmm. where it looked like the Greek government would not just collapse, but they would fall out of the Eurozone because of default. Mm-hmm. She was a hardliner, but her views essentially prevail there. So I think there's no question that she has been the most dominant player in Europe and one of the three or four dominant players in the world geopolitical scene. And so I think that was smart. And I must say, just from a standpoint of the refugees, there are problems with refugees, of course, as you just suggested. Mm-hmm. But when you think about the pictures, you and I are, all of us are old enough to remember pictures of German Jews getting on trains. Mm-hmm. Heading to their deaths, and to see over the last year Syrian refugees coming off trains in Germany, welcomed by mm-hmm. Germans, cheering, applauding, just the kind of the optic of that yeah. is a positive for Germany, and I think mm-hmm. Positive for Merkel. So I think she was a good choice. Now, is she the most powerful person on the world stage? I mean, you could have made a case for a Putin. But I think Merkel.
Yeah, I prefer Merkel myself.
Oh,
as person of the year.
I do too. Yeah. I agree. Mm-hmm. I think it was a very mm-hmm. worthy choice.
Sylvester? I agree. I think she not only played an important role in the Greek debt crisis mm-hmm. and is playing one in the European refugee crisis, mm-hmm. she also was a major player in dealings with Putin in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
When the Ukrainians were asking for military assistance from the West, from the United States, mm-hmm. Angela Merkel stood firm, saying that that's not a solution, that mm-hmm. we cannot give them. It just escalates. I mean, mm-hmm. we give them military weapons, Putin escalates, and so on and so forth. So she takes these very tough positions. She's in a very tough position now, particularly mm-hmm. on the refugee issue, because, you know, Germany is one of the places that's accepted most.
Yeah, I think
almost a million.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she's now saying, you know, even though we want to be welcoming, we can't. Mm-hmm. We can't continue to do this. Mm-hmm. It's a tough position.
How does she get along with Obama?
I think they have a pretty good rapport.
Mm-hmm. Almost famously, very
yeah.
strong.
Yeah.
He likes her. You can just see, and I've been to several of their joint press conferences, mm-hmm. The body language is very positive, and often in the case of Obama, the body language is a real tip-off. Just yeah. consider Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. The two of them get in a room, and it's yeah. like they're in different corners of the room.
As a cliche goes, you can feel the tension.
Exactly yeah. right. I think there's another point I'll make very quickly that is often overlooked, especially by people like me. Merkel is one of the few politicians in the world who can really talk dirty to Putin. And one of the reasons for that is she grew up in East Germany and she speaks...
Talk dirty?
Well, I mean talk tough is what I mean. That's a political jargonism in the U.S.
I know. I just
she can talk tough. She can say things to Putin that probably other heads of state or heads of government yeah. can't. And one of the reasons for that is she grew up in East Germany. She yeah. speaks fluent Russian.
Yeah.
And I think mm-hmm. that's a small stylistic mm-hmm. point, but I think mm-hmm. it's an important one.
All right. The UN Security Council now says we're going to take some measures to stop the flow of money going to ISIS, Islamic State. When I heard that several days ago, Sylvester, I mean, what occurred to me, why in the world aren't they already doing this?
Well, I think that there's been some pretty clear issues about, you know, security and tracking these guys and how these guys move. I think people have been basically caught off guard mm. by the network. I mean, how broad mm. this network really is. It's not limited to the Middle East. They have, you know, tentacles in many places, and those tentacles are being funded.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, where's this money coming from, and how is it getting to where it needs mm-hmm. to get? And I think the UN is finally starting to focus on that.
Well, it's about time. Mm-hmm. Where is the money coming from, Tom?
Well, it's coming. Some of it's coming from Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Some of it's coming from Jordan. Mm-hmm. Both countries essentially allies of the U.S., but mm-hmm. there are some radical sympathizers in those countries. A little here, mm-hmm. a little there, and it's hard to track. And they have had plenty of money to do their mm-hmm. evil. And mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. this is another example, Fred, by the way, that where the U.S. needs the Russians. This UN Security Council resolution on sanctions is co-sponsored by Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why the whole business about Syria, there are mutual interests all over the place.
But they haven't gotten any real help on the ground from the Russians against ISIS, have they, Sylvester?
Well, there have been a little bit. I mean, there have been some people actually killed on the Russians killed on the ground. But mostly it's the airstrikes, and which is as we said before, creating in some ways more chaos in the region than not.
Mm-hmm. So is there a real future there, Tom, anti-ISIS effort by the U.S. and Russia?
Well, I think it will be incremental, but it's better than nothing. And these sanctions will be stronger than what's been in place already. So it's a positive development. It's not the be-all and end-all.
Well, forgive me for not being overly optimistic. Anyway, time for another break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Tom DeFrank and Sylvester Monroe. And now we're going to get down to what I know what you all really wanted to talk about, not all this foreign policy stuff and Russia and the Middle East and all, but the Republican presidential debate. And well, we have another Democratic presidential debate coming up. But this one, you know, it was the third Republican presidential debate that's been nationally televised. Am I right about that? Well, anyway, and a couple things came out of it. One, that Donald Trump seemed fairly tame. And Jeb Bush, the former governor of Florida, and obviously the Bush family, attacked Trump as being the chaos candidate, and he'd be the chaos president and so on. I don't think there was much ground to plow there, actually. And then you had Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, both senators, both Cuban Americans, both conservatives, both Republicans. The one difference is that Cruz doesn't speak Spanish and Marco Rubio does. I think they're the same age, aren't they? Both 44, and they both poll pretty well. They're not quite as high as Trump, but I think in most polls they're going to lot of them. They're second and third. What about their clash, Tom? I'll start with you.
Well, basically, it was over immigration, where both of them kept saying the other was wrong, and they knew it. I think there's a larger dynamic at play here, Fred. I think there is an unwritten, unspoken agreement, whatever you want to call it, between Trump and Cruz, that they're going to be nice to each other because they want to make sure they're the last two standing.
Right.
And it's also very clear that Donald Trump, while being nice to Ted Cruz, is perfectly willing to have Cruz beat up on Rubio while Trump beats up on Jeb Bush, who is floundering, let's be honest about it, in the polls. He's at 5% or 4% or something like that. But basically, Rubio could be the emerging mainstream conservative threat to Cruz as number two. So we're going to see a lot of bashing between the two of them on judicial temperament, but basically immigration.
Now, and let me say before I get to you, Sylvester, that there hadn't been any actual voters weighing in yet. The Iowa caucuses start on February 1st, and then New Hampshire's on February 9th, and then the South Carolina primary comes 2 weeks after that, and then you get the Tuesdays when there are many more primaries on a single day. What did you take from the debates, or this most recent Republican debate?
Well, it was one of the major themes was national security.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't hear anybody really put forth any sort of realistic or concrete sort of ideas. I mean, Donald Trump defended his statements about, you know, needing to keep Muslims out of the country, banning Muslims to come here. And interestingly, I mean, surprisingly, shockingly, his numbers go up when he does that. I don't know how. I mean, I think you're right. I think the voting will tell. I mean, the polls say one thing. When people start to vote, if this continues, then I think one of the things we see from overseas is that people are just aghast at the Republican feel right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some people here are aghast at the Republican field there.
Including a lot.
I'm not one of them, but in any case.
Including a lot of Republicans, yeah. I think.
Well, indeed. But between these two guys, I mean, it's something, you know, usually you wind up later in a presidential race when you go through all these primaries and so on. You have the mainstream candidate, and then you have sort of an outsider candidate or the insurgent candidate or the other candidate or something. And the press really likes to get it down to two people, one-on-one. The easiest was in 2008 in the Democratic side when they got it down to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But with this huge Republican field, it's a lot more difficult.
Well, I think it's going to end up being three, essentially. It's going to be Trump, Rubio, and Cruz, unless Jeb Bush somehow catches fire. Now, I agree with you, Fred, as you suggested. I've always said numbers don't count at this point. And as you pointed out, it's 6 weeks before a single vote.
Yep.
But this time, some numbers count. And the fact that Donald Trump is over 40% heading into a two-week situation.
Well, in at least one poll.
At least one poll, but in the high 30s and others. We're heading into the holiday season in the United States, so these numbers will be frozen until the first of the year. And it's hard to see how Trump falls apart between January 1st and February 1st. I'm not sure he's going to win the Iowa caucuses, but he might. But
well, then if he loses something when the voting comes, you know, there's this question of whether Trump is for real or it's just a bubble. And when something like losing the Iowa caucuses happens, that will pop the bubble. And we've seen it happen with other candidates earlier. Remember Howard Dean a couple of cycles ago on the Democratic side, way ahead in the polls and lost in Iowa and whoosh.
That could happen here as well, but this is a big number. And I mean, every time, you and I, we've all said when Trump has said something crazy, well, that's it. The bubble has burst, and it doesn't burst. And I mean, if you know, basically,
Sylvester's point was, he got his pulse went up when he said no Muslims.
Yeah, when he said to hell with the Constitution, we can close our borders. Yeah. Too. It's quite extraordinary.
What happened to all the other candidates? They were there in that debate. There were four others. They seemed to have been forgotten.
It was like Ben Carson wasn't even on the stage. Yeah. I mean, he was once the front runner.
Yeah, and Carly Fiorina, you know, she hardly gets a mention. Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky. And who's the other one? Even I forget.
Well, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, came across as a very hardliner, and he said if the Russians had an airplane in our airspace over Syria, we'd shoot them down. Yeah. And others quickly said he's Dr. Strangelove. Mm-hmm. We don't want that guy's finger on the nuclear trigger. So you're right. It's basically Trump, Rubio, and Cruz and others at the moment.
Feel free to fudge on this answer, but my question is, well, from watching this, watching these Republican debates, who looks like he or she might be the strongest Republican candidate against probably Hillary Clinton in the general elections, Sylvester?
Well,
I realize that's hard to say.
The view is, or from where I sit, it doesn't seem that any of them is particularly strong against Hillary Clinton at this point. But perhaps Cruz.
Well, Tom? I still think the strongest Republican against Hillary Clinton would be Jeb Bush, but there's a long way from here to there, and I just think he's too deep in a ditch to pull himself out.
And how'd he get in this ditch?
Well, I think he assumed that the world had not changed since he left the Florida governorship about a decade ago, and that he thought he could somehow overcome the Bush name problem in the Republican Party, and he thought that having the most money and being an establishment candidate would do the job. He is not. I think he was a very skillful governor of Florida. I think he had a very strong record.
He did.
But I think he's not the world's best debater. The Bushes are kind of genteel about their style of politics. They hire people sometimes to do their dirty work. But
they hire the thugs?
I'm
exaggerating.
Yeah, I know. But the fact is he has not proven to be a particularly strong debater. Now, this last debate was his best one to date, probably best performance than the others combined, other previous debates combined, but we'll see.
Last question. Is Jeb Bush basically finished in the presidential race?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think, as Tom says, I think it's just too much. He's too far behind to catch up.
Mm-hmm. Well, he certainly has not been a sterling candidate, just personally as a candidate. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Sylvester Monroe, assistant foreign editor at The Washington Post, in charge of Europe and South Asia. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Jackson Witt and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.